me with everything he's got. He can't afford to lose this much face. Too many people would be laughing. Sadhna shook her head.
I can't do this thing. I can't leave my crew. No one will be with you.
With me and Pima.
Pima shook her head.
No, I'm not doing it.
You're not?
I'm not leaving my mom.
But we talked about getting out. Getting away from here.
Naylor tried to keep the desperation from his voice. For some reason, he had assumed they were crew and that they were together.
You talked about it, not me.
Naylor stared at her. Pieces clicked into place. Pima had family. Something to cling to. Something solid. Of course she wouldn't risk the run. He should have seen it. Naylor forced himself to nod.
Still, we can catch the train and make it to the Orleans in 2 days. It can't be that hard.
Pima held up her hand, showing him her splinted fingers.
You think? Rennie had both hands for the jump, and he still ended up looking like ground pork.
Sadhna looked down toward the beach.
We can broker a truce with your dad, Naylor. I can protect you.
If you think so, then you really don't know my dad.
Naylor shook his head.
Anyway, I don't want that. I want out. Lucky girl says she'll get me out if I help her.
Sadhna glanced at the girl.
And you believe her?
I'm telling the truth!
Nita started hotly. Sadhna waved her to silence.
Really?
She looked at Naylor.
You're sure she's worth it?
No one ever is,
Tuol rumbled.
My father can pay, Nita said. He can reward...
Shut up!
Pima said. She turned to Naylor.
Naylor decides. He's the one to take you. He's the one to take the risk.
She grabbed Naylor and pulled him aside. She lowered her voice.
You're sure about this?
She glanced back at Nita.
The girl's sly. Every time she tells us something, it turns out it's only half true.
I believe her.
Don't. Swinks don't think like us. She'll have an angle. You sure you're watching yourself?
There's no risk. I've got nothing here. There's no way I can keep clear of my dad if I stay.
Naylor shrugged, pulled away from Pima's grip.
My dad will never forget this. No matter what anyone says, he'll never forget.
He looked at Nita and spoke loudly to the group.
We'll go. I'll take her.
A flurry of activity down below startled them all. Pima scrambled up on a boulder peering through the foliage.
Get up here, lucky girl, she said.
Nita climbed up beside Pima, and Naylor joined them. Out on the dark water, a pale ship was anchored, lights glowing like the day, bright LED spots sweeping the water, catching the shapes of boats rowing toward shore. Nita shook her head.
They're coming for me.
They'll pay a reward, too,
Pima's mother said to Naylor.
Mom,
Pima shook her head.
We're crew, Naylor said stubbornly. I'm not selling her.
Pima's mother studied Naylor.
You run and Richard Lopez will hunt you forever. You can never come back.
She looked down.
You can still make a peace. Broker a deal and sell the girl to those people down there, and Richard will forget. You don't think so, but money will make him forget plenty. Moby and Blue Eyes and the rest are nothing in comparison to the amount of money we're talking about.
Nita watched fearfully. If he sold her, they'd be rich for certain. He could buy peace from his father.
Lucky and smart. I need to be lucky and smart.
The smart thing was to give Nita up, to buy the safety he couldn't beg for. But just handing her over to her enemies made him feel nauseous. The smart thing was to turtle down and let the girl go and make a profit in the bargain. Her fight wasn't his. He looked to Pima. She just shrugged.
I told you what I thought.
Blood and rust, he muttered. We can't just give her to them. It'd be like giving Pima to my dad.
But a lot safer for you,
Tool suggested. Naylor shook his head stubbornly. No. I'll take her to the Orleans. I know how to hop the trains.
This isn't light crew and a short quota, Tool said. You won't get second chances. You make a mistake now and you die.
You ever jumped the train? Sodna asked.
Rennie told me how.
Before he went under the wheels, Sodna said.
We all die, Tool rumbled. It's only choosing how.
I'm going, Naylor said. He looked at Nita. We're going. Something in the way he said it got it through this time. No one tried to protest. They just accepted it and nodded, and suddenly Naylor felt as if he'd made the wrong decision. He realized that a part of him had wanted them to talk him out of it, to find a way to convince him not to run.
You'd best be going then, Tool rumbled. Richard will be coming to sell the girl soon.
Good luck,
Pima's mother said. She dug into her pocket and offered Naylor a handful of bright linen red Chinese cash.
Run hard. Don't come back.
Naylor took the money, surprised at the amount, feeling suddenly alone.
Thanks.
Pima ran back to the camp and returned with a small pack that had been Blue Eyes. She handed it to Naylor.
Your scavenge.
Naylor took the pack, feeling water sloshing in it. He looked at Nita. Ready? Nita nodded eagerly.
Let's get out of here.
Yeah. He pointed through the jungle. The tracks are that way. They started out of the clearing, but Tool called after them.
Wait!
Naylor and Nita turned back. Tool studied them with his yellow killer's eyes.
I will go as well, I think.
Naylor felt a shiver of fear. We're fine, he said at the same moment as Pima's mother smiled brilliantly and said,
Thank you.
Tool smiled slightly at Naylor's hesitation.
Don't be so quick to turn down help, boy.
Naylor had a dozen retorts, but all of them were based in his distrust of the half-man's motives. The creature frightened him. Even if Pima's mother trusted him, Naylor didn't. It worried him that someone so close to his father and Lucky Strike was going with them. Why now? Nita asked suspiciously. What do you want? Tool glanced at Sodna, then nodded toward the beach.
The patrons down on the ship have half-men of their own. They will have questions about my presence. It will not be a convenience for anyone.
We can make it alone, Naylor said.
I'm sure, Tool answered, but perhaps you will benefit from my wisdom.
His sharp teeth showed briefly.
Be glad he's willing to help, Sodna said.
She turned to Tool and clasped his huge hand in both of hers.
I owe you now.
It is nothing.
Tool smiled and his sharp teeth showed again.
Killing in one place or killing in another, it makes no difference.
Chapter 15. The ground shook as the train came up at them. They crouched in the ferns. The engine roared toward them and then flashed by. Naylor swallowed as machinery rushed past. Wind pummeled his face and tore at the leaves of the trees and ferns around him. The train seemed to suck him forward to where the huge wheels, each as high as his chest, blurred past. They beckoned him to throw himself under their passing weight, inviting him to be chopped into pieces and left bleeding as the train roared on. With rising fear, Naylor realized that it was one thing to speculate idly about jumping a train, another to watch freight cars hurtle past. It was enough to make him reconsider his options, to review the possibility of stealing a skiff, of sailing the coast instead, or of walking the jungle and swamp route. But they had no supplies to make that run, and if they went by water, the clipper ship out in the bay would pursue them with ease. There was no other option. They needed to run, and they needed to run now. The train cars whipped past in a blur. From a distance, they seemed much slower. Now, close up, they were horribly fast. Was the train speeding up? When Rennie had jumped the train, it had always seemed to be going slower, had seemed easier. Naylor knew that depending on how aggressive the engineer was, the train could go much faster than was actually jumpable. That was how Rennie had finally gone under, misjudging the speed he could leap aboard. He'd also been drunk and stupid, but he'd been lulled by all his other successful jumps. Naylor and Nita and Tool all stepped out from the vines and clambered up the raised rail bed to the tracks. The wind buffeted them as the train roared past. The noise of rushing cars was as bad as a city killer storm. Naylor glanced back at his companions. Nita's eyes were wide with fear. Tool watched impassively, perhaps even with contempt. This would be nothing to the half-man. Naylor found himself wishing that Tool were big enough to simply pick them up and carry them as he jumped aboard. Quit fooling yourself. Hurry up and jump. They were running out of time. The end of the train would be approaching. He needed to commit. It was like being in the oil room all over again, knowing that the only way to survive was to dive, and dive deep. But that time he'd known that there were no other choices. This time, he kept trying to find another way out. Go, he told himself. But his feet stayed rooted. Rennie had jumped the trains all the time, had boasted about it. As Naylor's heart pounded in his chest, he tried to remember everything Rennie had ever told him. He took Nita's shoulder and shouted in her ear, "You run ahead of the car, let it catch up, and then grab the ladder and don't let go no matter what." He pointed at the wheels. "If you fall, you go under, so never let go, no matter how much it hurts." He said it again. "Don't let go." He paused. "And get your legs up in a hurry." She nodded again. He took a deep breath, trying to get his bravery up. Suddenly, Nita dashed ahead. Naylor stared surprised as she ran beside the train. She seemed pathetically small beside the rushing wheels and the ladders that ran up the sides. One ladder whipped past her. Another. She wasn't even looking at the ladders of the train cars. She was just charging along beside the train, her black hair bouncing behind her in a ponytail. One ladder, two, three went by. At the fourth, she leaped. Her hands caught the crossbars and she was jerked forward. Her legs flew into the air, torn out from under her. Her feet came down, then flew into the air again as she hit the ground. She was like a rag doll being dragged. She was going to be sucked under the wheels. Naylor waited, thinking he would see her torn apart. But then she curled her legs under her and she was suddenly aboard, clambering up the side of the train car. She hooked her arm in the ladder and looked back. Already she was becoming distant, carried away by the speed of the train.
"The end of the train is coming," Tool observed.
Naylor nodded, took another breath, and started running. Almost immediately he understood why Nita hadn't looked back. The ground was uneven beside the track, even though it looked smooth from a distance. The tracks where Rennie had jumped the train had always been smoother than this. Naylor had to keep his eyes ahead if he wasn't going to fall. Beside him, the speed and noise of the train were dizzying. Cars blurred past. He kept imagining himself tripping and falling under the wheels, torn apart by the train. He was running as fast as he could over the uneven ground, and still the ladders whipped past him. How the hell had she done it? How had she... He glanced behind, wanting to be able to see the cars coming up. The movement and noise were dizzying. He stumbled and almost fell into the train's rush. He caught himself and forced himself to look straight ahead, picked up his pace. He counted time as ladders flicked past. 1, 2, and then a count of 3 for the center of a train car to pass, and then 1, 2, again. He prayed to Pearlie's Ganesha and the fates. 1, 2, pause. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2. The first ladder flashed past. Naylor grabbed for the second. It caught his hand and slammed him away, spinning him. His legs tangled. He fell, rolling over gravel and weeds, and came to a stop. Train cars whipped past as he lay in the dirt, bruised and stunned. Blood ran from his scraped knees and numbed hands. His shoulder was a bright blossom of pain. Tool flashed by, hooked easily on a ladder. The half-man looked down at Naylor as he went past, yellow eyes watching, impassive to Naylor's failure. Naylor scrambled to his feet. Nita was almost gone. He started running. The end of the train was coming up. His leg was bruised from the fall, and he limped as he ran. His shoulder felt as if he'd torn it once again. Limping, he couldn't get as much speed. Ladders blurred past. Again he timed them. He glanced back. The end of the train was here. Now or never. Naylor put on a burst of speed and leaped as a ladder swept past. Instead of grabbing for a rung, he grabbed the side of the ladder with both hands. His shoulders exploded with pain as his arms were yanked forward and he was dragged with the train. His feet bounced over rocks, bright pain blossoms, and then he pulled himself into a ball dangling low off the ladder. The ground blurred beneath him. Wind ripped at his clothes, choked him with its heat and force. He scrabbled for a new handhold, found a rung, and pulled himself painfully away from the rush of rocks beneath. Another handhold, and then he was up and climbing with the wind tearing at him and the trees of the jungle blurring emerald as he shot past. His arms were shaking. His whole body tingled with adrenaline. His legs felt weak, but he climbed, clawing his way higher until he was at the top of the freight car and could see down the length of the train. His feet were scraped and battered. His knee was oozing blood. His hands were raw. But he was safe, and he was alive. Far ahead, Nita and Tool were watching. Nita waved. He waved back tiredly, then hooked his arm in the ladder and let his body shake. Eventually, he'd have to make his way down the length of train and rejoin them, but for now, he just wanted to rest. To be grateful that for the first time in days, clinging to a speeding train, he felt absurdly safe. He looked back the way he had come. The twin rails of the train tracks were being swallowed by the dense jungle. Every minute on this train took him farther from his past. He had to smile. His whole body hurt, but he was alive, and his father was in the distance, and whatever lay ahead, it had to be better than what lay behind. For the first time in his life, he was safe from his father. The thought of safety reminded him of Pima and her mother, still there, still facing more days on the cruise, facing whatever retribution his father might think to devise. It worried him. In the heat of the escape, he hadn't been able to concern himself with what the consequences might be for them. He had so desperately wanted to get away that he couldn't think of anything else. But now, suddenly, the two of them were on his mind, like spirit demons plucking at guilt. Looking back the way they'd come, he used his free hand and touched his forehead to the fates and prayed they would be all right. That they would be able to hold Richard off, that he would believe the story that Tul had betrayed him for the sake of a reward, and that Pima's mother and Pima hadn't been the ones who had stolen a lucky strike from his hands. Naylor prayed for the people he had abandoned, and then he turned his face forward again and let the wind rush past. He opened his mouth, gulping at the heat and speed and smells of the jungle. Through the trees, a flash of ocean showed, blue and bright. The train was slipping toward the shoreline. In the far distance, he caught sight of the moored clipper ship. Its sails glinted in sunlight, a white gull resting on a mere sea. He grinned at the sight, at the thought of all those swanks who would be scrambling now, trying to find them in the jungle, all of them never realizing they had been fooled and that their quarry had outwitted them. The view of the ship and ocean disappeared, hidden again by the emerald tangle of blurred trees and vines. Naylor turned and peered down the length of the train, looking ahead to where the towers of drowned Orleans would eventually rise. Chapter 16. The problem with a clever escape was that it helped to have planned for it. In their rush to slip away, they'd left with few supplies, and riding in the gaps between train cars meant it was impossible to scavenge for food. Within hours, Naylor was starving. He thought longingly of the dinner he'd had the night before. He would have thought that by sitting still they would have hardly needed to eat. After all, it wasn't like working light crew. But his body was already whittled by a lack of food from his time of fever, and now his belly pressed against his backbone. There was nothing to do about the problem, so he gritted his teeth and felt his belly grind on emptiness and promised himself he would scavenge a feast when they arrived in the drowned city. The train, in addition to the access ladders to the roofs, had tiny service platforms between the cars, but these were hardly more than steel planks 2 feet wide, suitable for standing and working, but terrible for hours of riding. Early on, Tul made his way down the length of the train, hunting for open bays in the train cars, but he was unable to crack any of the sealed compartments, and so they huddled in the train gaps, with the ground blurring beneath them and the wind whipping all around. It was awful, and yet still better than the hot roofs of the train with no protection at all from the blaze of the sun. Sleeping on the brink of the wheels was nearly impossible. They pinned themselves between the ladders, perched precariously above the blurred ground, and slept in nodding shifts that broke off at abrupt moments when the train jerked forward or slammed to a slower speed. All of the train's braking and acceleration came in jerks and shuddering declarations that threatened to throw them off their perches. After Naylor and Nita were nearly thrown down into the train gap, they rode with their arms threaded through the ladders. Another time, as the train slammed itself to a lower speed, Tul almost crushed them, his whole bulk smashing them against metal and leaving Naylor's head ringing. But all of those discomforts were nothing against their lack of water. The few bottles they carried in their pack were quickly drunk, and by the second day all of them were parched and hollow in the heat and humidity. There was nothing to do but watch the landscape rush past and hope that the train would reach its destination soon. Sometimes huge lakes spooled past. They debated jumping from the speeding train into the cool, inviting water, but Tul shook his head and said that they would never catch a train again at this speed, and unless they wanted to spend days walking, they must suffer instead. Naylor resented the idea, even though he didn't want to ever try to jump a train again, and knew that the huge creature was correct. So while they killed time and watched the landscape roll past, they talked. "Who are the people who are after you?" Naylor asked Nita. "Why are you so important?" "It's Nathaniel Pice, a business marriage uncle." She hesitated, then said, He and his people want me for leverage.
Naylor frowned, confused. Nita saw his lack of comprehension.
My father learned about some of his dealings. Pice was misusing the family's corporate resources. Now Pice wants to use me to keep my father from making trouble. I'm the best way to put pressure on him.
Pressure?
Pice wants my father to allow something he disagrees with. If Pice controls me, my father has to acquiesce.
Pice stands to make billions, and not in dollars. Chinese red cash. Billions.
Her dark eyes bored into him.
That's more money than your shipbreaking yards will make in their entire lifetime. It's enough to build 1,000 clippers.
And your dad's against that?
It's tar sands development and refining. A way to make burnable fuel, a crude oil replacement. The valuation has gone up because of carbon production limits. Pice has been refining tar sands in our northern holdings and secretly using Patel clippers to ship it over the pole to China.
Sounds like a lucky strike to me, Naylor said. Like falling into a pool of oil and already having a buyer set up. Shouldn't your dad just take a cut and let this Pice run with it?
Nita stared at him in shock. She opened her mouth, closed it, then opened it again, closed it. Clearly flummoxed.
It's black market fuel,
Tool rumbled.
Banned by convention, if not in fact. The only thing that would be more profitable is shipping half-men, but that, of course, is legal. And this isn't at all. Is it, lucky girl?
Nita nodded unwillingly. Pice is avoiding carbon taxation because of territory disputes in the Arctic. And then when it goes to China, it's easy to sell it untraceably. It's risky, and it's not legal, and my father found out about it. He was going to force Pice out of the family, but Pice moved against him first.
Billions in Chinese red cash, Naylor said. It's worth that much? She nodded. Your father's crazy, then. He should have done the business.
Nita looked at him with disgust. Don't we already have enough drowned cities? Enough people dying from drought? My family is a clean company. Just because a market exists doesn't mean we have to serve it.
Naylor laughed. You trying to tell me your blood buyers get some kind of clean conscience? Like making some petrol is different than buying our blood and rust out on the wrecks for your recycling?
It is.
It's all money in the end, and you're worth a lot more of it than I thought. He looked at her speculatively. Good thing you didn't tell me this before I burned the boat with my dad. He shook his head. I might have let him sell you after all. Your Uncle Pice would have paid a fortune.
Nita smiled uncertainly. You're serious?
Naylor wasn't sure how he was feeling. It's a lot of damn money, he said. The only reason you think you've got morals is because you don't need money the way regular people do. He forced down a feeling of despair over a choice that was made and couldn't be gone back on. You want to be like Sloth? He asked himself. Do anything just to make a little more cash?
Sloth had been both a traitor and a fool. But Naylor couldn't help thinking the fates had handed him the biggest lucky strike in the world and he'd thrown it away. So how'd you end up in the storm if you're so valuable?
My father sent me south to keep me out of reach if there was violence. No one was supposed to know where I was.
Her eyes got a faraway look.
We didn't know they were coming. We didn't suspect.
She corrected herself.
Captain Arensman said we needed to run. He knew. I don't know how. Maybe he was one of them and changed his mind. Maybe he had a feel for the fates.
She shook her head.
I don't know. I'll never know now. But I didn't believe him, and so I delayed. And our people died because I didn't believe I was at risk.
Her face hardened.
We barely got out of port, and even then they were after us, chasing us all day and all night. When the storm came, we didn't have any choice. It was either try to run the storm or surrender. Captain Arensman gave me the choice.
You couldn't make a deal? Naylor asked.
Not with Pice. That man doesn't negotiate when he's already won. So I told Arensman to head into the storm. I don't know why he agreed. The sea was already high.
She made a motion with her hands.
Waves coming over the decks, almost impossible to walk, and no clear winds. Just a storm howl all around us, tearing us to pieces. I was sure I was going to die, but if we surrendered to Pice, it would have been the same.
She shrugged.
So we turned into the storm and the waves kept coming and our sails snapped and we lost our masts and the waves came in through the windows.
She took a shuddering breath.
But Pice's people turned back.
You risked everything,
Tool rumbled.
I'm a chess piece. A pawn, she said. I can be sacrificed. But I cannot be captured. To be captured would be the end of the game.
She stared out at the greenery.
I have to escape or die. Because if I'm captured, they will have my father, and they will make him do terrible things.
If your father wishes to sacrifice himself for you, Tool said, perhaps he knows best.
You wouldn't understand.
I understand that you sacrificed an entire crew to a storm.
Nita stared at him, then looked away.
If there had been another choice, I would have taken it.
You have loyal people, then.
Not like you.
She said it with surprising venom. Tool blinked once, slowly, yellow eyes bright.
You wish that I was a good dog man? That I had kept allegiance to Naylor's father, maybe?
He blinked again.
You wish that I was a good beast like the ones on your clipper ships?
He smiled slightly, showing sharp teeth.
Richard Lopez thought your clean blood and clear eyes and strong heart would fetch an excellent price from the harvesters. You wish I had stayed loyal to that?
Nita gave Tool a dirty look, but her knuckles were pale as she clenched her fists.
Don't try to scare me.
Tool's teeth showed bright and sharp.
If I wished to scare a spoiled, rich, protected creature, I would not have to try very hard.
Naylor interrupted.
Cut it out, you two.
He touched Tool's shoulder. We're glad you came with us. We owe you.
I didn't do it for your debt, Tool said. I did it for Sodna.
He looked at Nita.
That woman is worth 10 times whatever your wealthy father is worth. 1,000 times what you are, whatever your enemies may foolishly think.
Don't tell me about worth, Nita said. My father commands fleets.
The wealthy measure everything with the weight of their money.
Tool leaned close.
Sodna once risked herself and the rest of her crew to help me escape from an oil fire. She did not have to return, and she did not have to help lift an iron girder that I could not lift alone. Others urged her not to. It was foolhardy, and I, after all, was only half of a man.
Tool regarded Nita steadily.
Your father commands fleets, and thousands of half-men, I am sure. But would he risk himself to save a single one?
Nita scowled at him, but she didn't reply. Silence stretched between them. Eventually everyone settled down to sleep as well as they could in the creak and jolt of the train. The great drowned city of New Orleans didn't come all at once. It came in portions. The sagging backs of shacks ripped open by banyan trees and cypress. crumbling edges of concrete and brick undermined by sinkholes. Kudzu swamp clusters of old abandoned buildings shadowed under the loom of swamp trees. The train rose into the air, rail pilings lifting it over the swamps below. They passed over cool green pools full of algae and lily pads, the white flash of egrets and the whir of flies and mosquitoes. The entire elevated track system was reinforced against the city killer storms that rolled into the coast with such astonishing regularity. But it was the only evidence that any people successfully inhabited the jungle swamplands now. They sped above the mossy brokeback structures of a dead city. A whole waterlogged world of optimism, torn down by the patient work of changing nature. Naylor wondered at the people who had inhabited those collapsing buildings. Wondered where they had gone. Their buildings were huge, larger than anything in his experience at the shipbreaking yards. The good ones were built with glass and concrete, and they'd died just the same as the bad ones that seemed to have simply melted in on themselves, leaving rotting timbers and boards that were warped and molded and sagging.
"Is this it?" Naylor asked. "Is this the Orleans?"
Nita shook her head.
"These were just towns outside the city, support suburbs. They're everywhere. Stuff like this goes for miles. From when everyone had cars."
"Everyone?"
Naylor tested the theory. It seemed unlikely. How could so many people be so rich? It was as absurd as everyone owning clipper ships.
"How could they do that? There's no roads."
"They're there," she pointed. "Look."
And indeed, if Naylor scrutinized the jungle carefully, he could make out the boulevards that had been, before trees punctured their medians and encroached. Now, the roads were more like flat fern and moss-choked paths. You had to imagine none of the trees sprouting up in the center, but they were there.
"Where'd they get the petrol?" he asked.
"They got it from everywhere," Nita laughed. "From the far side of the world, from the bottom of the sea."
She waved at the drowned ruins and a flash of ocean.
"They used to drill out there, too, in the Gulf. Cut up the islands. It's why the city killers are so bad. There used to be barrier islands, but they cut them up for their gas drilling."
"Yeah?"
Naylor challenged.
"How do you know?"
Nita laughed again.
"If you went to school, you'd know it, too. Orleans city killers are famous. Every dummy knows about them."
She stopped short.
"I mean..."
Naylor wanted to hit her smug face. Tua laughed, a low rumble of amusement. Sometimes Nita seemed okay. Other times she was just swank. Smug and rich and soft. It was those moments that made Naylor think she could have learned a thing or two on Bright Sands Beach, that even Sloth, with all her greed and willingness to betray him, had been better than this rich swank, who still looked pretty even after living amongst them all, as if she weren't touched by the grime and pain and struggle that the rest of them felt.
"I'm sorry," Nita said,
but Naylor shrugged away her apology. It was clear what she thought of him. They rode in silence. A village showed through the jungle, a clearing carved from the trees and shadows, a small fishing community perched amongst the bogs, dotted with slump shacks like the ones that Naylor's own people constructed, with pigs and vegetables in their yards. To him, it looked like home. He wondered what Nita saw. At last the jungle parted, opening on a wide expanse where the trees were lower and the height of the train gave them a view. Even from a distance, the city was huge. A series of needles piercing the sky.
"Orleans, too," Tool said.
Chapter 17. Naylor craned his neck to see over the tops of the trees and take in the mangled metropolis.
"There's got to be good scavenge there," he said.
Nita shook her head.
"You'd have to knock down the towers. You'd need all kinds of explosives. It's not worth it."
Depends how much copper and iron you can pull, Naylor said. Put a light crew in the building, see what's what.
You'd have to work in the middle of a lake.
So? If you swanks left a lot behind, it would be worth it.
He hated the way she acted like she knew everything. He stared out at the towers.
I'll bet the good stuff's been stripped, though. Too good to leave lying there.
Still.
Tool nodded at the many buildings spread out and covered with greenery.
A lot of scavenge if someone organized.
Again, Nita disagreed. You'd have to fight with the locals for scavenge rights. Fight for every inch. If it weren't for treaties and the trading militias, even the transshipment zone would be contested.
She made a face.
You can't bargain with people like that. They're savages.
Savages like Naylor,
Tool goaded. Again his yellow eyes flickered with humor as Nita blushed and looked away, pushing her black hair behind her ear and pretending to watch the moving horizon. Whatever Nita thought of the scavenge opportunities, there was a lot of abandoned material spread out before them. And if Naylor understood correctly, this was just Orleans, too. There was also the original New Orleans. And then there was Mississippi Metropolitan, a.k.a. MisMet, what had been originally envisioned as New Orleans 3, before even the most ardent supporters of the drowned city gave up on this spectacularly bad luck enjoyed by places called Orleans. Some engineers had claimed it was possible to raise hurricane-resistant towers above Pontchartrain Bay, but the merchants and traders had had enough of the river mouth and the storms, and so left the drowned city to docks and deep-sea loading platforms and slums, while they migrated their wealth and homes and children to land that lay more comfortably above sea level. MisMet was far away upriver, and higher in elevation, and armored against cyclones and hurricanes as none of the others had been, a city designed from the ground up to avoid the pitfalls of their earlier optimism. A place for swanks that Naylor had heard was paved in gold, and where gleaming walls and guards and wire kept the rest of the chaff away. At one time in the past, New Orleans had meant many things, had meant jazz and Creole and the pulse of life, had meant Mardi Gras and parties and abandon, had meant creeping luxurious green decay. Now it meant only one thing. Loss. More dead jungle ruins flashed past, an astonishing amount of wealth and materials left to rot and fall back to the green tangle of the trees and swamps.
Why did they give up? Naylor asked.
Sometimes people learn, Tool said.
From that, Naylor took him to be saying that mostly people didn't. The wreckage of the twin dead cities was good evidence of just how slow the people of the accelerated age had been to accept their changing circumstances. The train curved toward the hulking towers. The shambled outline of an ancient stadium showed beyond the spires of Orleans II, marking the beginning of the old city, the city proper for the drowned lands.
Stupid, Naylor muttered.
Tool leaned close to hear his voice over the wind, and Naylor shouted in his ear,
"They were damn stupid!"
Tool shrugged.
No one expected Category 6 hurricanes. They didn't have city killers then. The climate changed. The weather shifted. They did not anticipate well.
Naylor wondered at the idea, that no one could have understood that they would be the target of monthly hurricanes pinballing up the Mississippi Alley, gunning for anything that didn't have the sense to batten down, float, or go underground. The train flew over its pylons, curving toward the center of the trade nexus, speeding over brackish water, bright with leaked waste oil and scrap trash and the stink of chemicals. They shot past floating platforms and transshipment loaders. Massive containers were being loaded into clipper ships via cranes. Shallow draft Mississippi River boats with their stubby sails were being loaded with luxuries from across the ocean. The train rolled past scrap and recycling yards, Men and women's backs sheened mirror-bright with sweat as they stacked handcarts with purchased scrap and moved it to weighing platforms for sale. The train began to slow. It shunted onto a new series of tracks, dipping down to a barren zone of rail yards and slum shacks, before shunting again. Wheels squealed on steel and the train cars shuddered as the brakes were applied. The ripple of the slowdown thudded back through the cars to the tail of the train. Toole touched their shoulders.
We get off now. Soon we'll be in the rail yards and then people will ask why we are here and if we have the right.
Even though the train was going slowly, they all ended up falling and rolling when they hit the ground. Naylor stood, wiping dust from his eyes and surveyed the area. In many ways, it was not much different from the ship breaking yards. Scrap and junk, soot and oily grime, and slumped shacks with people watching them, hollow-eyed. Nita surveyed her surroundings. Naylor could tell she wasn't impressed, but even he was glad they had Toole with them, someone to protect them as they threaded between tightly packed shacks. A few men were lounging in the shade, tats and piercings showing unknown affiliations. They watched as the three interlopers moved through their turf. Naylor's neck prickled. He palmed his knife, wondering if there would be bloodshed. He could feel them evaluating. They were like his father. Idle, crystal sliding probably, dangerous. He smelled tea and sugar, coffee boiling, pots of red beans and dirty rice. His stomach rumbled. The sweet reek of bananas rotting. A child ahead of them urinated on a wall, watching them with solemn eyes as they slipped past. At last they poured out onto a main street. It was full of junk and scrap dealers, men and women selling tools, sheets of metal, rolls of wire. A bicycle cart rattled by full of scrap. Tin, Naylor thought, and then wondered if the driver had purchased it or was selling it, and where it might be going.
Now where? Naylor asked.
Nita frowned. We need to get to the docks. I need to see if any of my father's ships are there.
And if they are?
Toole asked. I need to know the captain's names. There are some I know I can trust still.
You're sure of that?
She hesitated. There have to be a few. Toole pointed.
The clippers should be in that direction.
She motioned Naylor and Toole to follow. Naylor glanced at Toole, but the massive man seemed unconcerned at her sudden authority. They trudged down the thoroughfare. The smell of sea and rot and crushed humanity was strong, much stronger than in the ship-breaking yards, and the city was huge. They walked and walked, and still the streets and shacks and scrap bunkers went on. Men and women rode by on rickshaws and bicycles. Even an oil-burning car slipped through the broken streets, its engine whining and grinding. Eventually, the hot open slum gave way to cooler tree-covered lanes and large houses, with shacks around their edges and people going in and out. On them were signs that Nita read out to Naylor as they went by. Meyer Trading, Orleans River Supply, Yee and Taylor Spices, Deep Blue Shipping Corporation, LTD. And then abruptly the street slipped into the water, dipping down. Boats and river taxis were moored, men sitting with their oared skiffs and tiny scrap sails waiting to ferry anyone who needed to move into the Orleans beyond.
Dead end, Naylor said.
No, Nita shook her head. I know this place. We're close. We have to go through the Orleans to get to the deep-sea platforms. We'll need a water taxi.
They look expensive.
Didn't Pima's mother give you money? Nita asked. I'm sure it's more than enough. Naylor hesitated, then pulled out the wad of red cash.
Better to save it, Toole said. You'll be hungry later.
Naylor stared at the brackish water.
I'm pretty thirsty now.
Nita scowled at him. Then how are we supposed to get out to the clippers?
We could just walk, Naylor said.
Some people were wading out into the water, which seemed only waist deep. They moved slowly through the green and oily murk. Nita stared at the water with distaste.
You can't walk there. It's too deep.
Spend your money on water, Tool said. There will be a way for the laborers to get to the loading platforms. The poor will lead us.
Nita reluctantly agreed. They bought brownish water from a water shelter, a man with yellow rotting teeth and a wide smile, who swore that his water was salt-free and well-boiled, and after they had bought, he cheerfully directed them. He even offered to row them there, but he wanted too high a fee, and so instead they went the long way, threading around drowned and rotting streets, down floating boardwalks. The reek of fish and petroleum came in waves, making Naylor's eyes water and reminding him of shipbreaking yards. Eventually, they reached the shore. A series of buoys reached out into the placid water. Nita stared at the water with distaste.
We should have taken a boat.
Naylor grinned at her. Afraid? He asked. She gave him a dirty look.
No.
She stared at the water again.
But it's not clean. The chemicals are poisonous.
She sniffed.
There's no telling what's in there.
Yeah, well, that'll kill you tomorrow, not today. He waded out into the gunk and slime of the water. A thin, jewel-like oil sheen covered it.
It's better than around the shipyards. This is nothing at all in comparison to that. And it hasn't killed me yet.
He grinned again, enjoying taunting her.
Come on, let's go see if there's a clipper waiting for you.
Nita compressed her lips but followed. Naylor wanted to laugh at her. She was smart, but it was weird how damn prissy she was. He watched as she waded deeper into the water, enjoying the fact that the swank was about to drag herself around in the filth like a normal person for once. As soon as Lucky Girl was in, Tool waded after her, his huge form pressing a ripple in the lily pads and petroleum murk. They all started forward, walking slowly. The water deepened, rising to their chests. Ahead of them, someone had tied plastic buoys marking a lane for people without boats. One of them was orange, another white. As Naylor passed one, he spied the faded image of an apple stamped on its surface along with letters. Another had an ancient automobile embedded on its face. The path of discarded containers led them out to where the last portions of housing foundations disappeared and where much of the wreckage was gone, and still the path went on. They waded carefully through the waters, following a stream of struggling bodies that waded, swam, and splashed forward toward the far docks. At one point, Nita lost her footing and went under. Tool grabbed her and pulled her up and set her back on the careful path that everyone else followed. She pushed long, wet strands of hair off her face and stared to the distant ships and their docks.
Why don't they just use boats?
For these people?
Tool looked around at their fellow waiters.
They are not worth it.
Still, someone could make a boardwalk. It wouldn't even cost that much.
Spending money on the poor is like throwing money into a fire. They'll just consume it and never thank you, Tool said.
But it would probably save money for people to have easy access.
The water doesn't seem to stop them.
And indeed, there was a steady stream of people ahead of them. A few of them had scavenged plastic bags wrapped around some possessions that they wanted to keep dry. But mostly, the stream of people seemed unconcerned that they were forced to swim through the brown water and green algae. Nita waded on, grimly determined, Naylor thought, not to show how disgusted she was by her circumstance. Every time Tool spoke, his words were like a whip, lashing her. Naylor wasn't sure why, but he liked to see her embarrassed. Part of him sensed that she thought of him as something like an animal, a useful creature like a dog, but not actually a person. Then again, He wasn't too sure that she was a person either. Swanks were different. They came from a different place, lived different lives, wrecked whole clipper ships just so one girl could survive.
"Why are you even here, Tool?"
Nita asked suddenly.
"You aren't supposed to be able to just walk away from your patron."
Tool glanced at her.
"I go where I please."
"But you're a half-man."
"Half a man,"
Tool looked at her.
"And yet twice the size of you, lucky girl."
"What are you talking about?"
Naylor asked. Nita glanced at Naylor.
"He's supposed to have a patron. We take them on their oaths. My family imports them from Nippon after training, but not without a patron."
Tool's eyes swung to focus on her fully. Yellow dog eyes, predatory, examining a creature he could destroy in a moment if he chose.
"I have no patron."
"That's impossible," Nita said.
"Why's that?" Naylor asked.
"We are known to be fantastically loyal,"
Tool said.
"Lucky Girl is disappointed to discover that not all of us enjoy slavery."
"It can't happen," Nita insisted. "You're trained."
Tool's huge shoulders rippled in a shrug.
"They made a mistake with me."
He smiled slightly, nodded to himself, enjoying a private joke.
"I was smarter than they prefer."
"Oh?" Nita challenged. Again the yellow eyes evaluated her.
"Smart enough to know that I can choose who I serve and who I betray, which is more than can be said of the rest of my people."
Naylor had never thought to wonder why Tool was amongst the shipbreakers. He had just been there, much as the boat refugees had been. The Spinoza clan and the McCallies and the Lowells had all come to work, and so too had Tool. They were there for the work. But it was true what Lucky Girl said. Half-men were used for bodyguards, for killing, for war. Those were the stories he had heard. He'd seen them with Lawson and Carlson's bankers, seen them clustered around the blood buyers when they came to inspect the yards, but always with others. Swanks. People who could afford to buy creatures mixed from a genetic cocktail of humanity, tigers, and dogs. And they were expensive. The human eggs that jump-started their development were always in demand and commanded a high price. The life cult often supported itself on the ovum of its devotees, and the harvesters were always buying.
"Where's your master, then?" Nita asked. "You're supposed to die with your master. That's what ours always say. That they'll die when we do. That they will die for us."
"Some of us are astonishingly loyal,"
Tool observed.
"But your genes..."
"If genes are destiny, then Naylor should have sold you to your enemies and spent the bounty on Red Rippers and Black Ling whiskey."
"That's not what I meant."
"No? But you descend from Patels, and so you are all intelligent and civilized, yes? And Naylor, of course, is descended from a perfect killer, and we know what that means about him."
"No, I didn't mean that at all."
"Then do not be so certain of what my kind can and cannot do."
Tool's eyes bored into her.
"We are faster, stronger, and whatever you may think, smarter than our patrons. Does it worry the Swank Girl to run across a creature like me, running free?"
Nita flinched. "We treat your kind well, my family."
"Don't bother. My kind will serve you regardless."
Tool looked away and kept waiting. Nita fell silent. Naylor pushed on through the waters, thinking about the strange conflict between the two of them.
"Tool," Naylor asked, "did they train you? Did they make you have a patron?"
"A long time ago, they tried."
"Who?"
Tool shrugged.
"They are dead now. It hardly matters."
He nodded at the approaching docks.
Do you recognize any of the clippers?
Nita looked out at the ships against their floating docks in the distance. Not from this far.